All right, good morning, everybody. It's time for us to get started. We are in Joshua chapter 13, and we're looking at the inheritance that Moses gave to the 2.5 tribes on the east side of the Jordan. So remember, we're getting into this inheritance section. God has given Joshua the new commission to divvy out the inheritance to Israel. But before we get to that, we are reminded of how Moses has already been obedient in this regard. And so a lot of this, again, is going to be tying Joshua's work back to Moses' work and showing how they are congruent, how they continue with each other. We finished off last week by looking at the inheritance given to Reuben. And we noted that some of the place names, and this is something, by the way, that we will see the book of Joshua hinting at more and more strongly as we go along. But at this point, we're given some fairly subtle hints, I think, for us, of the seeds being sown for future apostasy. Right? Israel's future troubles are being, at this point, foreshadowed. Later on in the book, they're going to be, I think, a little more explicitly foretold. At this point, it mainly consists of some of the place names that we are looking at. I want to start with this because this is going to be a continuing theme for this section of the book, and I want this to be at the front of our minds. Some of these we had covered already. I had forgotten about this one, though. It was last Sunday. It was kind of tickling the front of my mind like I'm forgetting something. I'd forgotten about Bamot Baal. Bamot Baal is honestly maybe one of the most explicit ones out of this list. And I had completely forgotten what the Hebrew word Bama means. You know what? Do you know what the Bamot are? High places. The word Bamot means high places. So one of the cities that makes up Reuben's territory is called High Places of the Lord, Bamot Baal. Now, early on in Israel's history, maybe this didn't signify anything, at least to them, having to do with idolatry. We know, for example, that the word Baal, I mean, first off, the word Baal just means Lord in Hebrew. To us, we always think of it as like the proper name for one of the idols, Baal. And that's ultimately what it becomes. But the Hebrew word Baal just means Lord. And we know for example, looking at some of the genealogies, that at some point in Israel's history, they undergo this shift in the way that they use the word Baal. I'll give you an example. Let me find it again. It is in Chronicles. Where is it at? Here we go. I think maybe the earliest place, or the best place would be 1 Chronicles chapter 9, verse 39. I want to show you this. It's pretty cool. We can see this transformation happening in the Hebrew language. And again, this will give us a sense of what happens with these names later on. Now, this is kind of some foreshadowing for us. 1 Chronicles chapter 9, verse 39, we're in the genealogy section of Chronicles. And we read, Ner fathered Kish, Kish fathered Saul. Here we're talking about King Saul. Saul fathered Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, and Eshbaal. Eshbaal, right? That's an interesting name there. You know Eshbaal, most of you who have read biblical history. Right? Obviously, we know Saul, infamous king. We know Jonathan, the close friend of David. You've probably heard the name Abinadab, too, because he comes up every once in a while in David's story. Eshbaal is an interesting name because it means man of the Lord. And the Ish there just means man, Baal means Lord. So, that's a nice godly name to name your son. Man of the Lord. Until until Baal worship becomes a snare to Israel, and they start to figure out that the Baal that they have been worshiping, the Lord that they have been worshiping after the pattern of the Canaanites and after the pattern of some of the other nations who live among them, until they figure out that's actually not acceptable. That's not our God. That is a heathen God. And we need to distinguish ourselves between them. You want to know who you normally know, the name that you normally know Eshbaal as? Ishbosheth. It's the same name, Ishbosheth. Ish means man, except Bosheth does not mean Lord. He means shame. Because at some point in Israel's history, there's this shift where everything that had contained the word Baal for Lord gets changed to Bosheth, meaning shame. Because they recognize that their relationship with the Baals was shameful to them. All right, so early on, again, at the point that we're reading it, it may not have crossed any of their minds that, hey, this is a high place to another god, and we really ought to tear this place down and should give it a new name. But to somebody reading Israel's history later, like during the time of David, or later than that, or during the time of the Gospels, and to us today, this is some big foreshadowing. They've got a place called High Places of Baal in their territory. And they have a place called the House of Baal of Meon in their territory. Bet Baal Meon. That's a place where the local form of Baal in Meon is worshipped. And of course, last week we talked about Bet Peor, the place where Balaam incited Israel to go worship the Baals and sin against God. And then we also mentioned Bet Yeshimot, that might refer to another place named like Bet Peor. Right? The Baal is not explicit there, but Bet Peor is the house of Baal of Peor. Bet Yeshimot might be another pagan place name, depending on how we understand it. Yeshimot just means deserts. Deserted places. And so this would be House of the Desert Places. It could be a house of Baal out in the desert, or it could just refer to some place where people go for refuge in the desert. We're not sure about that one. But a lot of these other place names, excuse me, again, signify to us that, that Baal is still present and active in the inheritance that Israel is receiving. All right, so I just wanted to remind us of that from last Sunday before we jump back into our text for today. Any questions or comments about any of that, by the way? We've had to kind of rush through that last Sunday. Any questions or comments before we continue on? Yes, Lyle.
So what you're suggesting, maybe these people would regret that their name is that. The way someone with Hitler would change his name.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of if you had somebody with the name of Hitler or somebody who had been named Adolf as a kid, because Adolf was a very popular German name for a long time. Now nobody's named Adolf, right? That's similar to what happens in Hebrew between Baal and Bosheth. So instead of just taking on a wholly new name, the text signifies that the name Baal had been there, but we're ashamed of that name now. And so we're going to signify that. Solomon?
Do you have some kind of New Testament reference where there's a variant in some passage where it says, I was a husband to you, a Baal, but then the variant is Gaal, which means I was a...
I don't remember off the top of my head. I would need to do some digging into that. Yeah, and if you find the passage that you're thinking of, let me know. Okay. All right, so let's We looked at Reuben in chapter 13, verses 15 through 23. Let us continue now to verse 24. So we're in Joshua 13, 24. Moses gave an inheritance also to the tribe of Gad, to the people of Gad, according to their clans. Their territory was Jazer and all the cities of Gilead, and half the land of the Ammonites to Aroer, which is east of Rabbah, and from Heshbon to Ramath Mizpah and Bethanim, and from Mahanaim to the territory of Debir, and in the valley, Beth Haram, Beth Nimra, Sukkot, and Zaphon, the rest of the kingdom of Sihon, king of Heshbon, having the Jordan as a boundary to the lower end of the Sea of Kinnereth, eastward beyond the Jordan. This is the inheritance of the people of Gad, according to their clans, with their cities and villages. Okay, so to explain some of these place names and give us a sense of what's going on with Gad's inheritance. The Sea of Kinnereth, we better know by the name Sea of Galilee. So that's one of the boundary markers for Gad. And Gad's territory includes some pretty famous and important places for Israel's history. You've got Gilead, which is going to become more important later on in Israel's history. You also have Mahanaim. You might remember Mahanaim as the place where Jacob receives one of his visions of the Lord. Right? Mahanaim means two camps. And it's the place where, Jacob recognizes that there are two camps here. Right, his camp and the Lord's camp. And he has a famous meeting with the Lord at Mahanaim. Gad's territory also includes Sukkot, which is another place that Jacob inhabited in, if I remember correctly, Genesis 35. That's where Jacob lived, was Sukkot. Sukkot just means tents or houses. The text, besides showing us that Gad had some of these famous places in its territory, the text also demonstrates something about the way that ancient landholdings are marked off that might seem odd to us. All right, so compare the city list for Gad. All right, so you've got all the cities of Gilead, half the land of the Ammonites to Aroer, which is east of Rabbah, from Heshbon to Ramath Mizpah, Bethanim, Mahanaim, Debir, Beth Haram, Beth Nimra, Sukkot, Zaphon. You have all of these cities. Now compare that with the text that we just read from Reuben. All right, if you look at the city list for Reuben, you've got Medeba, Heshbon, Dibon, Bamat Baal, Beth Baal Meon, Yahaz, Kedemot, Mapaat, Kiryataim, Sibma, Zeret Shahar, Beth Peor, Pisgah, Beth Yeshemot. You have both of these territories include Heshbon, which was the seat of Sihon's kingdom. Remember, we're describing territory that used to belong to Sihon, king of the Ammonites. So this all would have been one kingdom, and it basically gets split up between Reuben and Gad on the southeast end of Israel. So east of the Jordan, on the south side of that. And both of their territories include this pretty big and important city, Heshbon. We will learn later on, by the way, that Heshbon is also going to be apportioned out as a Levitical city. All right, so this is a city that technically does not belong either to Gad or to Reuben, although it's listed in the territory markers for both of them. It actually belongs to the tribe of Levi. One of the things that I want us to get from this, by the way, is that sometimes, and we're going to see this a lot through Joshua, so I figure we might as well establish this now. Ancient borders were not the clear boundary lines that we think of today. Right? Like the way that we set up boundaries in the modern world is there is a definite, sharp line. It's arbitrary and imaginary, right? But it's a sharp line. to the point that, for example, I don't know if y'all have ever made this drive on Interstate 24 between Atlanta and Chattanooga. Yeah, y'all ever made that drive before? How many times do y'all swap back and forth between Georgia and Tennessee as you get close to Chattanooga? It's kind of silly, isn't it? Like, you, I-24 kind of winds back and forth and kind of goes across the Georgia-Tennessee line a couple of times. And so you'll be in Georgia, then you're in Tennessee, then you're in Georgia again, then you're in Tennessee. And it's like, I don't care. If I die on this interstate, I do not care whether I'm 2 feet on this side into Georgia's territory or 2 feet on this side into Tennessee's territory. It does not matter. But that's just the way that we set up boundary lines. In antiquity, again, obviously they don't have the same kind of like mapping, the same kind of technology that we have, and they're not as picky as we are. And so it makes a lot of sense for them to say, yeah, this list of cities here, yeah, that's the border. Who's it belong to? Here, it clearly belongs to Levi, Heshbon does. Some of these cities, as we go along, the answer really is more like, does it belong to Simeon? Or does it belong to Judah? Or does it belong to Benjamin? Wayne?
In the same place, just very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Things happen like that. In the exact same place up in Central Mountain where my family used to live. You know?
Uh-huh.
The time's up.
Yes. There's this arbitrary line. Yes.
Standard on our front lawn.
Yeah.
And a central standard on our back lawn.
Uh-huh.
And we were traveling back and forth between Easter's and Central back and forth all over.
Right. Yeah, you go take a nap in your backyard and all of a sudden you're late. Yeah. And it's funny. That's just the way that we treat things, and the ancients had no concept of any of that. So there is a lot of overlap. In the case of Heshbon, very likely you're going to find a really mixed population there of Reubenites, Gadites, and Levites. For the sake of time, we'll hold off on reading the text where it's laid out as a Levitical city. That happens in chapter 21. We'll come to it when we come to it. We're going to find, by the way, the same sort of thing going on with Mahanaim, except on the other side. All right, we're going to see it being part of the territory of Gad and also part of the territory of Manasseh, which we'll get to in just a second. First, any questions or comments about any of these places? Okay. Let's jump into then verse 29. Excuse me. And Moses gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh. It was allotted to the half-tribe of the people of Manasseh according to their clans. The region extended from Mahanaim through all Bashan, the whole kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, and all the towns of Yair, which are in Bashan, 60 cities, and half Gilead, and Ashtaroth, and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. These were allotted to the people of Machir, the son of Manasseh, for the half of the people of Machir, according to their clans. All right, this is the shortest description in this section, but it's a big territory. It includes 60 cities, which is huge. It includes the northern part of Gilead, which gives us a little bit of overlap with the tribe of Gad, because Gad also includes Gilead. Whereas Gad and Reuben inhabit the former kingdom of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, the half-tribe of Manasseh inhabits the old kingdom of Og, the king of Bashan. We get another hint here of future idolatry to come, mainly in the form of Ashtaroth. So I'll go ahead and add it to our list here. Ashtaroth, which is the Hebrew form of the Mesopotamian goddess Ishtar. Excuse me. So it's a city named after Ishtar. And the Ashtaroth are going to become another snare in Israel, just like Baal does. Let's see. Finally, the text also reminds us, and this is a detail that I'm sure none of us were holding on to in our minds. I wasn't. I had forgotten about this. Manasseh only had one son. His name is Machir, which is why we only hear of one clan, at least in this part of Manasseh. These were allotted to the people of Machir, the son of Manasseh, for the half of the people of Machir according to their clans. When we get to the other half tribe of Manasseh later on in the book, we're going to learn that the rest of the people of Manasseh are split up according to a larger number of clans that come from, I think all of their fathers are Gilead, the son of Machir. So it's kind of weird how the clan system in Israel works, right? Like among the Levites, for example, we read of the, and of course their names have just slipped my minds. I had two of them like 5 seconds ago in my head, and I was trying to remember the third one, and while I was doing that, forgot the other two. Levi had three sons, all right? We'll bring it down to that. Levi has three sons. And those three sons become the heads of the three clans of the tribe of Levi. And so anytime that you read about Levites, particularly in the law and in the histories, they are split up according to those three clans. That's the way it normally runs with the tribes of Israel, is the clan names come from the sons of the patriarchs. But in some odd cases like Manasseh, where you only have one son, Machir, later on they get split up even further. And if I remember right, Machir only has the one son, Gilead. Gilead finally has multiple sons. And so we have multiple clans named after him. But then it gets complicated even further, because half of the clans of Manasseh are going to be named after women. All right, so we'll get to that when we get to it. But I just want to show you, there's the way that Israel organizes itself is, again, it might strike us as kind of funny and weird, and it's complex to keep in line. All right, so let's finish the chapter. Verses 32 and 33. These are the inheritances that Moses distributed in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. The Lord God of Israel is their inheritance, just as he said to them. All right, so we had gotten this reminder earlier in the text about Levi, and it's repeated again. So in verse 14, we had already read, to the tribe of Levi alone Moses gave no inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord God of Israel are their inheritance, as he said to them, to him. Excuse me. And so here, kind of bookending this description of the inheritance on the east side of the Jordan, we have this reminder about Levi, how he doesn't have any inheritance in Israel. We're going to get this reminder again, by the way, because it's also true on the west side of the Jordan. And instead, what Levi gets, we're told two different things, but these comprise the two things that Levi is told in the law of Moses. In verse 14, what Levi inherits is the offerings. That's Levi's inheritance. That shows, we might call it Levi's material inheritance. That's what he lives off of. At the end, verse 33, we're given Levi's spiritual inheritance. Right? The Lord God of Israel is their inheritance, just as he said to them. Showing that there is something significant about Levi's special relationship with God that is something that the rest of Israel does not quite have. and it's something that makes up for the lack of a land inheritance. Now, this is something, by the way, that's going to point us forward into the gospel. Because right now, Israel understands inheritance basically the same way that all of their neighbors understand inheritance. It's the land. But God is teaching Israel through Levi that I have a better inheritance to offer you guys. I am your inheritance. And he begins teaching that, again, through the tribe of Levi, so that by the time that Christ comes around, and by the time that Paul is writing to the churches, it should just make better intuitive sense to us, and I think it makes intuitive sense to us today, for us to say that our inheritance is the Lord himself. Right? That's the promise that we expect. We don't expect land. In fact, we even understand that the promised land is a type for heaven, for salvation. All right, so that finishes up the inheritance that Moses gave east of the Jordan. Any questions or comments about that before we get to chapter 14? Okay, so let's jump the river. Chapter 14, verse 1. These are the inheritances that the people of Israel received in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel gave to them to inherit. Their inheritance was by lot, just as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses for the 9 1/2 tribes. For Moses had given an inheritance to the 2 1/2 tribes beyond the Jordan, but to the Levites he gave no inheritance among them. But the people of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and no portion was given to the Levites in the land, but only cities to dwell in with their pasture lands for their livestock and their substance. The people of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses. They allotted the land. All right, so this introduces the next section of the inheritance, which is the main chunk of the inheritance, chapters 14 through 19, pertaining to the 9 1/2 tribes west of the Jordan. And notice, we get another reminder of Levi's status. Levi doesn't get any inheritance in the land. Although here we're reminded of another aspect of basically the deal that the Lord struck with Levi. So they receive the sacrifices. They have the Lord himself as their inheritance. Their earthly portion, as it were, is the cities. Right? No portion was given to the Levites in the land, but only cities to dwell in, with their pasture lands for their livestock and their substance. So that is the extent of Levi's material inheritance. Excuse me. We also get a note about Joseph contributing two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, which makes sense of the tribal allotments still being 12, even though one of them is not receiving an allotment. The text also introduces to us, at least for the first time in this book, the way that the allotments are to be given. They are to be done by lot. Now, that's been discussed in the law before, and for the sake of time, we're not going to go back. If you'd like to look, it's at the end of Numbers chapter 33, and in Numbers chapter 34, beginning in verse 16, you can look at those passages where the Lord commands, this is the way the land is supposed to be divvied up. It's to be done by lot, and it is to be done with the aid of Eleazar the priest. What we read here, though, is just simple obedience to that commandment. That Israel allots the territory in the way that the Lord prescribed in the law of Moses. It continues that theme that we saw from the first half of the book, where Israel is obedient and does as the Lord says. And so now it's not just Joshua's job to allot the territory. It's Joshua with Eleazar the priest and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel. And these are the ones that are going to set up the boundaries west of the Jordan. The rest of the chapter is fairly short. And that's where I'd like us to spend the remainder of our time this morning. So let's go to verse 6. Then the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal. And Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in my heart. But my brothers who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Yet I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God.' And now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said, these 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Israel walked in the wilderness. And now, behold, I am this day 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there, with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said." Then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb the son of Jephunneh for an inheritance. Therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord, the God of Israel. Now the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim, and the land had rest from war. All right, so this is the first of what we sometimes call the land grant narratives. There's going to be a set of five of these. It's where a person or a group of people come to Joshua and remind him about the promises given to them by Moses regarding the land. So we're going to read this again from a guy named Aksa, from the daughters of Zelophehad, whom we've already met. The sons of Joseph and the sons of Levi, they're going to come to Joshua and remind him of Moses' promises. This first land grant goes to Caleb, the faithful spy. And we're going to be, this apparently was an important land grant, because we're going to be reminded of it at least one more time in the book of Joshua, and then again at the beginning of the book of Judges. And one of the first things that might strike us about this is, all right, so how is the land supposed to be apportioned? Like we just read at the beginning of the chapter. How are they divvying up the land? What method are they using? Through lots. All right, what does not happen with this land grant? There's no casting of lots. All right, we immediately get an exception to the norm that was just stated. The land is not given by lot. Instead, Caleb's inheritance is given to him because it's the territory that he spied out 45 years earlier and reported faithfully about. Excuse me. And by the way, that gives us some sense of the time that has passed. 45 years since the Lord spoke to Moses. So you've got the 40 years of the wandering in the wilderness plus an additional 5 years since Israel has crossed the Jordan and entered into the promised land. That's when this particular event happens, although it doesn't necessarily give us a complete sense for how long the conquest took. Because the last thing we're going to look at is there's something odd going on here. And again, it comes down to the way we record histories and the way that we tell stories versus the way that the Hebrew people recorded histories and told stories. Because we have heard about Hebron before. We have heard about the Anakim in Hebron before. Go back to chapter 11, verse 21. Chapter 11, verse 21. All right, so this is the end of Joshua's second campaign. And Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua devoted them to destruction with their cities. There was none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, in Ashdod did some remain. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal allotments, and the land had rest from war. All right, now, you fast forward to Caleb's request. And he says in chapter 14, verse 12, "So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with the great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out, just as the Lord said." Then Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. All right, and we find, by the way, similar wording gets used at the very end of that verse. The land had rest from war. Now, to our modern-day English brains, this sounds really bizarre because we expect everything in a narrative to travel in a straight line. Right? Like, what is going on here? Joshua has already, and again, the text is very clear, there was none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel. They're already dead. How are they still alive? How is Caleb talking about the Lord will be with me to destroy the Anakim? Does not compute. Right? Our computer brains blow up. Right? We got sparks coming out of our necks. What this suggests to us, well, I don't know, since we're here at the end, let me leave it to you guys. What do you guys think is going on here? What explanations could you guys give for this? This is absolutely not a contradiction, by the way. Right, that is the dumb atheist explanation for what's going on. Oh, the Bible's just contradicting itself. It's not. What do we think is going on here? Rena?
Well, I remember a couple of weeks ago you told us that when they describe how they go in there and kill everybody, that in other words, that was their figure of speech, even though they may not have gotten their children.
That is a possibility. It could be that there are some left behind. The text does say none of them were left. But again, we have noted that sometimes the text will tell us, even in the same sentence, yeah, they were all dead, but then the survivors got away. That's a possibility. Solomon?
Is it kind of the same way that the tribe of Levi's long dead, and yet, you know, it says, Levi went up, did this and this. And so it's just saying that the people of the land are mimicking in the spirit of the Anakim.
Possibly. It kind of amounts to the same thing where we would be talking about descendants of Anak. And what kind of separated them apart was that they were mighty men, and some of them were giants. Excuse me.
One meant just like they were pagan. And uh-huh. So just saying that these people are the Anakin, even though they're not. No.
Maybe. I don't know. I consider that to be a little less plausible, but it will say possible.
Okay.
Again, at this point, we should talk about possibilities. There's also something that, again, it generally doesn't compute with the way that we record histories and tell stories, but it's something that's really normal for Hebrews to do, is that, in fact, we see it happen with Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, right? When is everything done being created? Well, I mean, like, how many creation accounts are there? Like, how many creations were there? Right? Those are kind of different questions. The creation happens all in one go, but we're told about it twice in Genesis. It is normal in Hebrew storytelling to give the broad strokes of a story and then kind of shift gears to talk about another set of details and recount an event that chronologically actually belongs like over here. Right? It's being told later on. Or actually, I should make this face your way. I'm making it face my way. So we start over here, and we've got this broad stroke of the story beginning to end. And then after the end of that story, we come back and we get some more details about that story that, again, in the text, it happens later, but chronologically, it actually happened kind of earlier on, if that makes sense. Possibly what's going on here is that the text is recounting for us something that happened while the conquest was still going on. That Caleb comes to Joshua and makes this request and says, hey, God promised me this bit of territory here. Let me go conquer it for you. And in the midst of that second campaign, Joshua says to Caleb, sure, go do it. The Lord gave it to you. Go take that land. And so Joshua gives Caleb Heshbon, or Hebron, rather, not Heshbon. Gives Caleb Hebron and all of the territory around it. All right, I apologize, we've gone over time today. We'll pick up with chapter 15 next week with the allotment for Judah, the rest of the allotment for Judah. If you just kind of preview chapter 15, it's a long chapter. We will try to get through that next Sunday and again try to make some sense of the place names so our eyes don't glaze over. So thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments today.